Since 1937, Ducks Unlimited has been the leader in waterfowl conservation, with over 16 million acres of habitat conserved. DU supporters and volunteers have led the charge to fill the skies with waterfowl, today, tomorrow, and forever. You too can play a role in leaving a legacy for the future of waterfowl hunting. To find an event near you or to join our volunteer team, go to www.ducks.org/volunteer. Ducks Unlimited. Conservation for a continent.
Welcome to the Standard Sportsman Podcast. The show features trending topics, touching all aspects of duck and goose hunting in an effort to motivate others to leave the resource better than they found it. Hosts Cason Short and Brent Birch are lifelong Arkansas hunter conservationists, delivering thought-provoking discussions with engaging guests before, during, and after duck season. Thanks for spending time with us today. Now let's jump into today's show with the guys.
Hey guys, it's Brent and Cason back with another edition of the Standard Sportsman Podcast. We appreciate you tuning in. A week that's mostly spring break for many people across the country. And it's been a few weeks since we recorded. We've had some episodes in the bag that kind of had in reserve because we knew this was going to kind of be a busy time. Cason's got kids that are of spring break age, and he's been busy with that. So we're back on the mic for the first time in a while. So Cason, what's it feel like to be back?
Yeah, man. It's nice to have a little break, but it feels like it's been forever since we've sat down and hashed something out. So knock the rust off here, cobwebs, whatever, and get back at it here.
For over 30 years, Lyle Real Estate has been connecting land investors and outdoorsmen with sellers. Whether looking to invest in an income-producing farm or recreational land, the Lyle Real Estate team has the connections and the expertise to help. They work with tracts of all sizes and specialize in agricultural, timberland, and recreational properties. New listings are hitting the market almost weekly, so head on over to their website to learn more. www.lylerealestate.com.
Yeti. From the legendary hard coolers to the new barware series, Yeti has you covered. Or check out one of my favorite new products from them, the Loadout Series Go Box. Yeti, built for the wild.
Yeah, so I guess one thing that, you know, that's kind of come and gone since we've talked is the Game and Fish Survey. You know, that wrapped up last Friday as far as their 30-day window of public comments. And I know we talk a lot to people, you know, quote unquote on the street. I haven't heard much on the survey results other than the number that participated in the waterfowl portion. And at last check, I think somewhere the number we got was around 20,000. So
that's right.
Blows away the less than 3,000 that took it the last time we did this. So I think that's a positive. We'll see what the results say.
Yeah, it's a positive. Regardless of the results, I would say it's a positive. You get more people involved in the process. Not that that is a part of the process and not that they're voting, but they're at least engaged as hunters. And look, whether we, you know, whether everyone agrees with us or disagrees with us, that's not really the point. The point is that you care enough to have an opinion. So I'm happy that they filled it out. And I wonder if they'll post or share the results. Full disclosure, if I was them, I would not. I would keep those cards close to the vest. You know, it's good that they care what the public thinks, but like we talked about before, if they tell everyone what the opinion was and they go a different route, maybe because the opinion is not backed by science, then it kind of gives them a black eye, like, oh, they didn't listen to us. That's what's wrong with the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission. So I don't know.
Yeah.
I wouldn't tell everybody.
No, I think you're right. I think those cards should be played a little closer to the vest because it's a survey. It's not a vote. We've said that on here before, and that's key. The Game and Fish Commissioners were appointed by the governor to be that authoritative body on doing what's right by the resource and by the people and everything else. And it's a combination. And a lot of times when people take a survey or get asked a question, it's what's best for them. It's not always what's best for the resource. And so those commissioners got to juggle all that. They got to juggle the science, they do have to juggle what the people want. There's an element, there's a human factor and all that, but in the end, they're charged with making those decisions. That's what they get paid the big bucks, so to speak, and are in that role. So I think I'd be curious on that survey, not necessarily to know which way a survey response, which way it favored. I'd like to know, did this 20,000 that took it this time around, did they take it and answer all the questions, or did they take it because they were really worked up about mud motors, or they were really worked up about early spec season, mm-hmm. or they were really worked up about the duck dates that were put in front of them? I think that would be interesting to see if some people kind of glazed over or skipped some questions or you got to take into the factor that maybe they answered some questions. They don't really have a dog in the hunt and they just answered it. So that's right. Another reason why they can't go on just strictly on what the survey says, because you may have people answering about early spec season that have never even shot a speckle belly, mm-hmm. Or don't have a mud motor, don't even touch the public woods. So you got to have that factored in there too.
Yeah, you know, and I thought they did a good job this year separating segments of the survey, so you could, you know, choose to take the fishing or the big game. You know, you could pick and choose what you wanted to do. I think last year it was the whole thing, straightforward, one end to the other. And, you know, I'm sure we lost some people who didn't get to the waterfowl section. So I thought that was an improvement. I do think you should have to enter your license number to fill this thing out. It's going to cut down on multiple applications. It'll cut down on non-hunters filling out a survey. You know, so that's another reason. If you get upset that they didn't vote the way that you thought they should, keep in mind that there's nothing that keeps a, you know, segment of the PETA population from filling this thing out. You know, so
yeah,
I'd love to see a little bit more, not background, but just a little door that we have to enter to fill this thing out and make sure they're actually all hunters and they did hunt in the state of Arkansas.
Yeah, that's a good point. Because, yeah, there was nothing to deter you from doing multiple entries. So, you know, if somebody wanted to sit there and do it. Now, I've been told that the data scientists and the software that they use to accumulate these has some safeguards in it to catch and prevent somebody from just spamming the form.
Okay.
But I know you can fill out more than one because I tested it. So now, whether it throws my second entry out or not, you know, I guess time will tell, but I've been told from the Game and Fish that they do have some safeguards in place. So mm-hmm. it sounds like it would be tough to spam it, but I guess we'll find out. But again, it's just a survey of public opinion, and public opinion isn't always on target or thinking things through. So it'll be interesting. I think they go through the process of kind of evaluating this, but still taking public feedback if you were able to reach one of them or run into them on the street or something like that. But they'll go through an evaluation process. They're obviously waiting on some things to happen as far as how it's going to look on the in Prairie Canada and the Prairie Pothole region here in the United States, and as they get closer to making those decisions. But it sounds like the May commission meeting is when these things will be set. So we've got, you know, there's a little bit of time for them to sift through everything and not do anything rash based on where we are now.
Yeah. So if I understand it correctly, they will, at the next meeting mid-April, they will propose the regulations and then kind of table it for a month, come back in May and actually approve, or depending on feedback, make another proposal, although that's not usually the case. Is that how that process is going to work?
You know, I'm not sure. I'm not sure if they have another, because if they do another reading, I think they have to do another 30-day window of public opinion. So they've already done the reading and put those proposed out there. I just think they have this amount of time to evaluate. And of course, you and I, based on our advisory council roles, have been asked to come speak based on what our advisory councils have heard and seen and put together. So, you know, I know I've gone through the process of getting feedback from for the guys that are on my council, which expand well beyond waterfowl, because there's deer hunting input, there's bear hunting, there's things related to dogs hunting, mm-hmm. All of that I've gotten feedback on, turkeys. So, be making a presentation on that. But in Arkansas, duck hunting seems to generate the most opinion and input. So I know we're supposed to do that in April if that continues to be in the card. So that'll be interesting to speak to that and possibly answer questions that come up in that commission meeting.
Did you say you're giving a presentation?
Well, I don't know if it's a presentation. I'm not going to PowerPoint start doing anything. My homework. I'm not going to PowerPoint anything by any means, but right. I do think we're supposed to share what our councils have,
right.
What they've heard, what people are thinking. And, this is beyond the survey and provide some feedback that maybe offers some stuff that maybe even wasn't even asked because, I'm not a deer hunter. So, I didn't wade into that part of the surveys, but I rely on my guys that are on the council that are pros at this and talk to a lot of people. So, it'll be an interesting process. Maybe the first time to do this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I didn't want to get there and be outclassed because I didn't come prepared. So, but that's a good point that you brought up. There's mine is habitat and access. So there's a lot more, dare I say, like industry professionals, Ducks Unlimited, backcountry hunting, fishing, all that. So there's a lot more, not knowledgeable, but we're spread out over a lot of different segments. So like to your point, I don't have a lot of opinion on trout fishing or even the commercial fishing aspect, but there are members on my council that do and that are informed on that. So what you and I read and share to the commission should be a very broad opinion across the state from different segments. So I like what they're doing. I think it's a positive thing to reach out and get input like this from us and from these committees. So.
No, for sure. For sure. I think it's a great process to feel like we the public, so to speak, have a voice. And that's what this is a accumulation of. Now, we're not going to know every voice, but there's some things that were interesting to me in wildlife that I don't chase, that are hot topics right now. So getting all those in front of the commission for them to evaluate, they've got their hands full. There's lots of stuff going on beyond worrying about just ducks.
For sure. Yeah. And I'll say this, I heard no numbers attached to it, but I did hear that it sounded like the majority of people who filled out the survey supported some sort of regulation regarding mud motors. Now, pay attention to what I'm going to say right here. It is not coming this year. Nothing is happening right now. This is for at least a year down the road. The point of it was to start exploring what, if a regulation was needed, what it would look like and what it would be. So I say all that to say, if that is something that you care about or have an opinion about, you need to start paying attention to it because it's going to likely be proposed next year. I think I made my opinion on it pretty clear when we did the episode about that, but I will state it again. I understand the argument against them. I understand the noise and the complaint over scouting and all those things, but like many other regulations that have been put in place regarding public hunting, dating all the way back to guides on public land, we continue to move the goalpost and somebody circumvents the rules and we end up with more regulation. So I am not a fan of that, of banning that particular motor because of how someone behaves with it. I think it's the behavior that's the issue, not necessarily the tool that's being used. But anyway, start paying attention to that. Don't be caught sleeping and shocked when something happens because you weren't involved in the process, so to speak.
Yeah, that was a tricky one. And what the method will be to regulate that, if that's the route the commission decides to go, that's a slippery one.
It really is, because if it's a noise thing, then enforce the noise law that's already on the books, or adjust it to a lower decibel level. I mean, those things are out there. So now, if the law or the rule is not regarding noise, okay, so then now it's about pressure, which you and I, you know, we preach that on here, pressure, right? So if you're banning them because people can access certain places, I'm not sure that's very legitimate either, because look, you get a properly set up outboard, you can run just as skinny as you can with a surface drive. Now, you may have to walk it back out of there once you stop, but you can get a lot of places with a proper setup. So, but again, we were going to penalize a certain demographic of hunters that use them because where people are choosing to go. And I guess that's why it seems so slippery to me, is you're trying to regulate common sense. We should know not to run up in the middle of these ducks and these rafts or in these places where they are secluded that you can't quite get to. We should know not to do that, but we're doing it anyway. And now we're about to pay the price for it. So I guess it all kind of comes back to the message we try to put out there on this platform. You know, common sense sportsmen wouldn't do some of the things that these people are being blamed for. I don't know. My grandfather would wear me out if I had driven past our rest pond or disturbed those ducks, you know? So it's, again, a behavior thing.
Yeah. And that's what's going to be hard to regulate. And, and it'll make people pay the price that are using those motors effectively and for increasing their opportunity, but are being mindful of rafts of ducks that are resting in the woods and, you know, not plowing through an area where, you know, red oak growth is regenerating and plowing through that in a motor that's basically nipping all those little trees right off at the top before they ever get going. It's really complex. It's a lot more to it than just, a noisy motor. And that's what they got to sift through and will be interesting, but, we'll see. We'll see what happens on that. I know, you know, some of the manufacturers are really worked up and concerned about it. What could be coming down the pike? And I can't say I blame them, because it's really hard to tell which way that could go. But that's just where we're at. Common sense would solve a lot of these problems, but it would solve a lot of problems in the whole sport if you really think about it.
For sure. Well, I don't think we've really talked about the flyway meetings. Not that you and I have a whole lot of hard data to share today. We've got some guests, I don't know, some feelers out there trying to get some people on. I know a couple guys that would be happy to jump on. Really, one in particular that we'd like to get on here. But there was, I don't know, some interesting stuff that came out of flyway meetings. In particular, something that I guess that happened a year ago that you and I weren't really... I wasn't aware of it or didn't notice the change. You may have been, but talk a little bit about the shift away from the North American Waterfowl Management Plan as far as AHM is concerned.
Yeah, that was just something I caught reading some other documents, some other reports that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service or the Mississippi Flyway Council put out. You know, being a complete duck nerd, stumbles maybe not the right word, but I wasn't aware of this until I read it about 2-3 weeks ago. But forever the Adaptive Harvest Management, AHM, you know, that sets the season frameworks and sets the limits, was using the North American Waterfowl Management Plan as kind of the basis for a lot of the science and the data and goals and markers that they set to manage the mallard population. Because, I mean, you see a lot of reports, you see a lot of people talk out there about, well, ducks are this, and ducks are doing that. And I'm not saying this because, you know, we're in Arkansas, and I don't want to be labeled a mallard purist, even though that's, you know, that's primarily what we hunt in the state. But rules and regulations are set off of mallards, the mid-continent mallard population for us. So mallards are what matters. It's great if canvasbacks, you know, have a record breeding year, but that's not going to change anything regulation wise because it's the mallard population. So you know, there's been one time, I think it was 10 million mallard goal. Then it was 8.5 million mallards was the goal for the North American Waterfowl Management Plan, you know, population wise, but not apparently. I mean, it happened. They, Mississippi Flyway Council, made note that they went away from using some of the basis of the Waterfowl Management Plan and went to a different model that I think is the integrated population model, which sounds like what it is. It's a bunch of data that comes from a bunch of different places and gets put into this model and spits out different info. It has a different way of looking at things than the North American Waterfowl Management Plan. But now this integrated population model is the backbone of what AHM is going to spit out as far as this matrix that May pond count and the BPOP breeding population get put into. So if you've ever seen it, it's a matrix of a bunch of L's, a few M's, and a little grouping of C's, and those are liberal, moderate, and conservative, which are the, you know, the three season frameworks that were afforded under AHM. Liberal being 60 days, six ducks, four mallards. Then the moderate is the 45-day, four ducks with three mallards, and then the conservative season is three ducks, two mallards, in a 30-day season. So this IPM, this integrated population model, is now a whole new way of looking at things. And it'll be interesting over time what that says as far as where we get plotted on that matrix and whether we're going to keep getting 60 and 6 or we're going to hit that little tiny window for the 45-day, or are we going to go from this, you know, 28-year run of 60 and 6 and all of a sudden, bam, we're at 30 when they do the counts. And so it's pretty interesting, kind of too early to tell, and we don't know enough about it. This is a bunch of science stuff that some people know about. And I've talked to Luke Naylor and tried to get an understanding of it, and I got an okay picture about what it is and what it's gonna do, but not enough to sit here and eloquently speak to it. And maybe that's an opportunity to maybe have Luke on and talk through some of that.
Yeah, it's interesting. I talked to a friend of mine on that committee, you know, that's privy to all that discussion. And I guess the language, you know, that the goal for 8 million mallards was too subjective. I was like, well, I don't understand. Like, how is a hard data point too subjective? And I asked the question, I was like, so is this just, you know, just business as usual? Is this just an attempt to be able to shift it wherever we want without having to achieve a goal, since we're not achieving that goal, we're not getting there, we're not reaching it. And I get it. It's habitat driven. That is the biggest reason we're not getting there. I mean, significantly biggest reason, but moving the goalposts like this kind of seems to me an attempt to avoid ever going to restrictive, which concerns me. We've seen a lot of comments on our social media about that as we talk about harvest and the significance of harvest. How big a role does it really play? And I think I put up a post this morning that commented, you know, the overwhelming, I guess, thought or defense to harvest doesn't matter is that, you know, let's look at mallards. Okay. So we're harvesting 17%. Well, if we only harvest 17% a year, we will never kill them all, because when we get down to 100, we're only going to kill 17, and so forth and so on. I'm not sure that's really revolutionary resource management in the current time that we're in.
Right.
I mean, I get it. Within the framework that we have, we don't surpass that 17% mark, really. So, and that's the deal with white fronts. You look at some of the Lincoln estimates that came out from the Flyway Commission or Flyway meetings. White fronts are at a, no one wants to believe this because they saw a big flock somewhere. They saw millions in this one field. Well, that's not true. Go look at the mid-continent population. There's not that many of them. But white fronts, along with other Arctic geese, are at a near 40-year low. And no one is concerned about it because we haven't met the threshold of harvest, so we're not harvesting too many. We're below 7% harvest on white fronts, and we are still below the threshold, or we haven't met the threshold for low population numbers, even though we are significantly low, some almost 60% population decline in the last 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
I understand, like, these statistics and the people that generate them, and it's good. I say good science. I mean, we still come back to the garbage in, garbage out consequence to a lot of this stuff. But I mean, the people that are doing it are some of the best and brightest. So definitely not questioning them. But I just, you look at that graph and you look at those numbers and you see how low these populations are, and you wonder, why are we not pulling the reins back? What's, and I'm not lobbying for shorter seasons either. I mean, I like 60 days, you know, but like the hen is that's a good thing we could talk about, right? There was a talk of going to three hens recently, three mallard hens in the Mississippi Flyway. For what? What's the goal there? I mean, as you said, or as Pat Pitt said on here, no one's duck hunting to feed their families. Why do we need to kill three hens? We don't do it with turkey or pheasants. We understand the penalty for killing females there, but for ducks, it's okay. I don't know. I wish maybe we weren't just trying to wring every drop of blood out of the resource at all times. Now, maybe leaving some stuff on the table really doesn't help populations, but man, you look at some of the charts we put up, some of the population numbers that we've put up on social media, and it's eye-opening. I mean, look at snow geese is another great example. That's a guest we intend to have on later in the year from Texas Parks and Wildlife. But snow geese are now below the number, the threshold that triggered the conservation order. Their population is below that. And as far as I know, there's only one state that's considering rescinding the conservation order. Well, you know, if you really go back and do the research on it, the damage that was being done to the tundra was overinflated. It really wasn't that significant. The conservation order has not ever achieved its goal directly. Its goal was to harvest adult birds. Now, in an indirect way, it does, because it kills juvenile birds who then don't become adults. But again, we were kind of sold a bill of goods when we passed it. It didn't really achieve its goal. And now the population's back in check. It's below that. Not that I don't think harvest ever got us there. So why do we still do it? And there's only one answer why we still do it. It's kind of like welfare. Once you give it to the population, no one's going to vote to give it back. And I get it. There's a lot of people that love doing it. There's a huge industry that surrounds it. And that's, to me, the only reason why it's still going on. Because the science doesn't say we need it. There's nothing that says, to my knowledge, and we'll hopefully, when we go down this path with our guest later in the year, we'll dive into this and get a lot more facts. I'm not that knowledgeable on it, but I don't think there's anything that says we should be continuing to use this conservation order as a tool to manage that population.
Oh, no doubt. No doubt. And it's, and you know, that is, it's so interesting. Some of the statistics and how they all flow in this thing. Cause it's a big puzzle, but you know, you mentioned the 17% part. That is the marker. If we go, 17% is what the mid-continent mallard population can withstand as far as being harvested. We could kill 70% and not really need to worry about it. We're at like 11% right now. So we're not even really close to the line that's been drawn in the sand that, we better be concerned about some things, because we just killed 18% of the population. So we're not even in the ballpark. Long way to go to get there. Now, if the population keeps sliding down, we're gonna get closer to 17%, because we're obviously on a decline. If you look at what numbers were before COVID and where they have been, you know, since COVID, you know, we had the 2 years that didn't fly for reasons I don't really understand. But, you know, there was a big decline that happened in the 2 years that didn't get flown. And then we've continued to see it the years since. So, you know, if that population keeps shrinking, we're going to get in the ballpark of 17% if hunting goes as it is and license sales don't take a huge plummet and everything else. But,
But it's interesting. You brought up the three hen deal, and that was something in some of my, you know, poking around and reading. This was in 2019 when they kicked around going to a potential three hens in the limit, because they were considering, the Mississippi Flyway Council was kicking around the concept that South Dakota and Nebraska are testing now. They call it the three splash rule up there. Mm-hmm. They were calling it a flat bag limit. So you could shoot three of anything, regardless of sex, but it was certain species. And then there was an alternative. There was a six duck flat bag limit, which contained things like teal, mallard drakes, gadwalls, you know, stuff we see in bigger populations. The stuff we don't see as much of, we're in this three flat bag limit. And one of the parameters in there was three mallard hens. Now, that was in 2019 when what do we have? BPOP was like 9.5 million or something like that. Where were we last year? 6 million. A lot more ducks back then. Things were riding pretty high, but we've obviously declined since. And that's not on the table any longer, either one of those things. But it's pretty interesting that those concepts were explored when our population was riding really high. Maybe thank goodness. Who knows? I mean, who knows if that would have got implemented, where we would be population wise on top of the droughts in Prairie Canada that we've seen the last handful of years.
Yeah, to your point about decreasing harvest and the potential to pass that 17%, you know, one of two things are going to happen. One is that we run that risk of passing that number. The other is that they'll just get so dang hard to hunt that we can't kill them. And we're seeing that a lot now. You know, we talk about nocturnal ducks and ducks don't move and they sit on the refuse. All these things, all these complaints that every hunter has, I mean, that's because the population is lower. You have less young birds, you know. So that's, one of the two. We'll either approach that threshold, or they'll just get really, really tough to kill. But Ray Alasaskas had a point, or I know he had a bunch of slides and a lot of Lincoln estimates at the meeting. And he talked about, I have to pull it up, but like a almost 80 or 87% decline in mallard hens, and talked about being potentially as few as a million mallard hens in the population. And then commented further, I believe, I don't have the slide now, I know I saw it because someone sent it to me, about the potential for over-harvest, and that there is the potential that we could kill a quarter to maybe a third of those mallard hens in one harvest season. And that's really maybe not very possible, but very alarming at the same time. I really want to get him on as a guest. I'd like to have him dive into that a little further for us, because I could be off a little bit on what I'm saying there, but I remember those slides. I think you and I shared them back and forth, and it was, I mean, just shocking, the numbers that he was putting out there from some of his research. And it, I don't know, I guess there's the point of all of this is there are a lot of people that have some really serious concerns about where we're at. And then there seems to be the other side that, it was just a mild year. You know, things will be fine next year. Well, somewhere in the middle has got to be the reality of things. Maybe the sky isn't falling, but it's not full of sunshine and rainbows either, as someone have you believe. Anyway, I guess we'll move on from this. Otherwise, I'll just bitch for the next 2 hours.
Well, I did have some conversations, because it became more apparent in some of the stuff, you know, conversations we were having. A lot of people were commenting on the sex ratios that we were seeing in mallards, you know, drakes and hens, you know, seeing a lot of drakes, not very many hens, because it came out of the Eric Reinhardt episode, because he saw it. And, you know, both of us have commented, we saw it. We talked to people, they saw it. And then you start seeing all the banding, and the banding is always skewed more towards the drakes. You're always going to catch more drakes in the pen than you are hens, but they were seeing abnormally high number of drakes. So I started asking questions and got some statistics. You know, I was curious, okay, well, what is the optimal, what is historical optimal ratio? And it was 55% of the population should be drakes and 45% of the population should be hens. I've seen numbers from two different scientists here lately that they think currently, one has said it's 4-1, drakes to hens. Another said it's 3-1, drakes to hens. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that gets back to your point of this potential overharvesting. I don't know if it can happen, you know, possible, I guess, but I don't know a hunter. I haven't talked to a single person that would be opposed to reducing our hen limit to one. You know, allow for that mistake, you know, maybe shooting like wasn't quite right, maybe pick the wrong bird, maybe two in one shot, you know, all the kind of things that happen. Because a lot of people aren't targeting hens. Most people prefer to kill drakes. That's obvious. But, sure. You know, there's days that, you know, you do get into some of them. You know, maybe, you know, especially if you're hunting in the woods and it's dark and you're getting shot calls, you know, before you can really tell. And then somebody's got to say, whoa, 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 hold up now. We got too many hens. And then you got the other side of that coin. You got the people that want so bad to take a picture with a limit that they're going to kill whatever comes in the hole. And if half the limit is brown ducks, they don't care, but they can tell them that they shot an 8-man or a 10-man or whatever it is.
Banged out a 10-man. I tell you what, if you guys do that this next year and if it's half brown, don't save that picture to post on St. Patrick's Day that you're all about that green. Because you're not all about it. You may be partway about it.
Yeah, I saw that one.
Yeah.
10 or 12 hens in the pile, but all about that green on St. Patrick's Day. Yeah.
Oh, and they had the hens down front too. Like,
yeah. Cause man, it was a limit. We got them.
Somebody told me the other day, maybe I was dropping some birds off with Pat. And I think his comment was, if it's not a limit or wearing a band or a hybrid, nobody cares about seeing it. That's all anyone wants to do is kill a limit, kill a band, or kill a hybrid. Nobody just talks about hunting anymore. It's all trophies.
He's pretty much on target like he normally is.
He's right about that.
The Standard Sportsman Podcast is brought to you by the following sponsors. Waterfowl hunters deserve to have a set of waders that can excel year in and year out throughout the duration of the season. So Sitka Gear set out to build the best pair of waders ever. Constructed from Gore-Tex Pro Laminate, the face fabric offers added durability and is breathable in active working conditions while completely sealing out the elements. Importantly, they proudly stand behind all of their Delta Zip wader features with their 100% serviceable guarantee. And I'm speaking from experience as I have sent my original pair of Sitka waders from the 2018 season back twice without a hiccup. Engineered to outwork, outlast, and outhunt everything else in the market, the Delta Zip wader from Sitka Gear is the gold standard for reliability. The Chatham jacket from Tom Beckby features a durable, weatherproof 8-ounce wax shelter cloth shell that develops a great-looking patina with use. I've actually worn this jacket the last couple of seasons and appreciate the shorter cut to it, so it fits great inside my waders. It's also a really good weight for most Arkansas days of field. So if you like to mix a little vintage look with your technical gear waders, this is the jacket. You can find the jacket online at tombeckby.com. You can also find it in their brick and mortar locations in Wilson, Arkansas, Birmingham, Alabama, and the new store in Oxford, Mississippi. But yeah, those ratios are a little squirrely and back up what the hunter sees. And that's where we get into this struggle, what we as hunters see with our own eyeballs versus what we see with these numbers that are extrapolated out of all these data points and had all these probability ranges and everything else. You know, a lot of times what the hunter's eyeballs are telling us, you know, if you're out there enough and you have a pretty wide lens, you're not just, you know, you're not, you're observing everything, not just what your harvest was that day. I mean, because there were days I saw a lot of ducks. We didn't kill them, but I saw a lot. Or I didn't see many and we killed them that day. You know, so there's all those dynamics that, you know, harvest isn't the way to tell whether the, you know, things are going okay or not. You know, a lot of people talking about, man, I'm seeing a lot more drakes than hens. I saw courtship flights really, really early, all those kind of things. And then some of these numbers where they think the population is, these 4-1 and 3-1 ratios are backing that up. You know, so sometimes the hunter's eyeballs don't lie.
Well, so, and I don't know if I mentioned this when we were talking to Eric, but we saw that really quickly with these transmitters on mallards. Now, everyone that's listening needs to know that predominantly transmitters. I can't speak for every biologist, but we were putting them on mallard hens because that's what we're studying, right? But we saw a mortality rate, primarily on the nesting ground, I think that was three times the mortality rate that AHM has in its matrix. Now, a lot of the sunshine pumpers will tell you that, well, that's the transmitter effect because that bird has a transmitter. And sure, it's been handled by humans. It is slower to flight because it's carrying that backpack. So there is definitely a transmitter effect. But I don't think you should just dismiss it entirely because it's starting to show up. What was completely almost laughed at pre-COVID for a mortality rate is now coming home to roost. We're seeing it. We're seeing a lot fewer hens. Now, that is, it's also habitat driven. That's why the population is declining. These hens are getting hammered on the nesting ground because the habitat sucks. There's not much of it, and what there is not great. But I think that comes back to our point about not killing as many hens. And for everyone that's, you know, well, hen harvest doesn't matter. You can't stockpile ducks. Sure, you can't. But if you sent back twice as many hens, or let's say you sent back 200,000 more hens, that's 200,000 more that predators could eat and not have an impact. Not trying to feed predators, but they are up there. So if there are more opportunities for them, then you're going to have a little bit more survival. And I think that's our mind and your point in a nutshell. If we choose not to kill them, then maybe they survive a little better in poor nesting conditions.
Yeah. Yeah. It's much more complex. I mean, all this stuff is, it's much more complex than just saying, you know, it doesn't matter. It's kind of like saying harvest doesn't matter. I mean, well, yeah. Yeah. When there's 10 million mallards, it doesn't, but when there's 6 million,
I couldn't help but send, you and Lee that, and Phil, that picture, I took my kids to the DU Museum over spring break, and we were looking at the punt guns and you know, the lights from the front of the boats and all that stuff in the market hunting days. And I sent a picture. I was like, I'm showing them that harvest does matter.
Yeah.
But that's, look, anybody out there who opens their mouth and says harvest doesn't matter, like I almost can't have a conversation with them from that point forward. You could rephrase that and say that harvest doesn't matter with the framework we currently have through AHM. Okay, now we can have a conversation. But if you tell me harvest doesn't matter, I'm going to start talking about passenger pigeon, buffalo, you name it. We have a distinguished list of species that we have driven to or nearly to extinction by harvest. And if harvest didn't matter, we could still bait. We could use call ducks. We could use punt guns. We could hunt them in October. We could hunt them in February or March. Harvest does matter. Now, there may be some stipulations in which it doesn't with certain framework, but if you just out and out hop on Instagram and say harvest doesn't matter, you're probably not going to get a response or a conversation from me. So,
yeah. Yeah. That's a tough one. That's a tough one. A lot of people are in that camp though. And you know, sometimes you find that those people are, you know, got a dollar to make in that business, that defend some of these concerns. And I'm all for somebody making a buck. Now, don't get me wrong, but you got to be realistic about some things and at least some thought into it versus kind of brushing that aside. Everything's fine. Keep buying what you're buying. Keep booking what you're booking. You know, all that. Got to take that with a grain of salt, I guess, when you see some of that stuff. But, you know, shit, I'm ready to see them bounce back. That's for sure. I'd rather have conversations talking about how many ducks there are than how many there aren't.
Yeah. Well, what do they say? Follow the money. I mean, certainly you and I would rather, the goal of this podcast is not to complain forever. Hopefully we get a lot of snow, things get better and we can talk about positive things. But right now this is the conversations that are being had. But yeah, you look at, people complain about Canada, right? And people complain about Mexico. And I understand that there's not a significant harvest going on in Mexico. I also understand that a fella can go to Mexico and basically do whatever he wants. Hard to justify that. You look at the number of pintail, and I get it. Overall, it's not significant compared to what's killed in Arkansas or the Mississippi Flyway or the U.S. as a whole. But, yeah, if you're one of the guys saying harvest doesn't matter and you're booking hunts to some of these places where harvest is portrayed as being absurd, then that may make sense where your argument comes from. I'll just say that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's a goofy one, too. I mean, so you can shoot 8 pintails in Canada, and you can shoot however many in Mexico, but you can only kill 1 here in the United States. It's kind of doesn't make sense. But, you know, some of our graphs and stuff we've put up have kind of raised some questions on this data part. And I think, you know, we'd like to keep digging and get some more clarity. And I'm not saying that they're wrong. They just, sometimes it's hard to connect the dots. You know, we'll have one coming up on duck stamp sales versus U.S. Fish and Wildlife active hunters number, and those numbers don't sync up.
If any of our listeners know somebody that we could talk to in that realm as far as how that information is gathered, I think you and I have got some leads on some folks, but would love to dive into that a lot, because that's an important metric that's being used, is this bird per hunter. You're like, oh, it's fine. Look, we're still killing this many. Well, I mean, the state of Arkansas alone, there's a 100% disparity between licenses that are sold and active hunters. They say there's 50,000 active hunters in Arkansas, but we sell 100,000 waterfowl license.
Yep, that's right.
Or stamps, excuse me. There are not 50,000 stamp collectors that are collecting Arkansas waterfowl stamps. Well, there's hunters that don't go. Okay, I don't think there's 25,000 that don't go, and I don't think there's 25,000 stamp collectors. So somewhere there, those numbers are off. And again, garbage in, garbage out. If those numbers are off, then we can't use the numbers of birds per hunter. Not to create season regulations, or we shouldn't be anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, because it factors into all of it. I mean, that's how harvest is calculated. And I mean, it's a number in there. And if it's off by that amount of margin, are we undershooting how many ducks we're killing in Arkansas? By half? Right. You know, that kind of thing. So it raises a lot of questions. But you know, we'll keep digging and see what clarity we can get and what we can share. I'm the same as you. I do not want a shortened season. We did it. It was fun, but it wasn't 60 days of fun. You know, because of all the circumstances we've mentioned on here, we don't get 60 quality days of hunting weather wise and everything else. So 30 days would make it even worse. But at the same time, I don't want us to just be plowing forward like everything's just okay. I know it can be better. I know the prairie pothole region can be better, and we can get more production than we've had the last few years. And it's going to happen. This stuff is cyclical. You know, someday the weather will be better. But you talk to some people talking about Alberta in production, they think Alberta's been dry for 20 years. That just doesn't get wet like it used to. And so is that a forever thing? I don't know, but 20 years is a long time. That's not a little 4 or 5 year blip like we're in now right now. So, and yeah, we can even talk about that, and it might be a good topic to end on, because it was, bad dry in Southeast Alberta and Western Saskatchewan, which is a big duck production area. But they did here in the last week or so, I think, got like a foot of snow. And I know Saskatoon got a foot of snow because it made some headlines with, even for Canadians, they were stuck inside and told to stay off the streets because the snow piled up quite a bit. So, still going to be a mild spring by all indications. I've seen there's been some talk of the El Nino shifting to the La Nina here in sometime between April and June. So you got all that weird, wacky weather stuff going on, but, at least that's a positive that they finally did get some precipitation up there, because it had been silly dry. And the Ducks are just now getting there, headed their way from parts of, you know, all the continental United States. Because we talked to Phil Konkey, you know, that we had on a few weeks ago, and he was starting to see a pretty good amount of mallards in South Dakota. So they've started to make their way back up that direction, and we'll get hopefully find some habitat when they push on past the border and get into Canada. Because as we talked about on here, as great as the Dakotas can look, they don't produce anywhere near the amount of ducks that Prairie Canada does.
So while you were talking there, I pulled it up. I finally, my map on NOAA for the snow and water equivalent runs a few days behind. So I heard about the snow last week and I've kind of been waiting for it to update. So I just sent it to you if you want to look at it from March 15th. And ugh. I don't know. I expected it to look better than that.
Yeah, I would
based on the reports of all the snow. Now I see on there where it's showing wet snow. We may post this on social media, so you guys stay tuned when you hear this. But I'm going to assume, even though it's showing the, you know, where the wet snow happened, it's still showing little to no water on the ground. So I'm not.
Yeah, I looked at something this morning. I looked at something this morning that said snow cover, and they still in Saskatoon or in Saskatchewan, they still had 5 inches of snow cover on the graph I saw. Now, I don't know if that's a certain area, what area that was, because it was kind of general information, but it was a graph that showed snow cover, and you know they got that 12 inches of snow, and it's steadily, you know, kind of been on the decline, but it still says 5 inches, and you know they're going to get a warm up. They're expecting mild springs like we are, and we have had until this last little snap this week. But you know, I would think as dry as it was, the ground's just going to suck up a lot of that.
Well, yeah, and then too, I think without that, you know, permafrost layer, it's not going to stay on top of the ground. It's going to, like you said, soak in. So
yeah,
I don't know. I mean, Matt may be better than it was, but it's a long way from good.
Yeah. Well, I guess point of all that is at least it's something, because it was pretty dire looking. There were people that were old enough. I wasn't old enough in the 80s to pay attention to this stuff. Now I duck hunted and I was a teenager, you know, most of the 80s, but I wasn't paying attention to this stuff. But, you know, talking to some people, we talked to Lee Jost, and he lives up there, spends a lot of time both sides of the border, and was like, this looks like the 80s right now. And of course, that was, you know, it was a few weeks ago. So maybe some stuff slowly improving, and maybe they'll keep getting some more, you know, some good spring rains and things. But man, they had a long way to go.
Yeah. Yeah, a long way to go for sure. And you know, for all the things you and I talk about, we know it is habitat driven. I mean, wet springs, good water cures most of the things that ail us. I think just right now, you and I feel like there's a lot more questions than answers, and things are in a lot tougher shape than to just be plugging along as usual.
Well, yeah, and it's kind of like we keep waiting on this epic wet spring on the Prairie Pothole region to fix everything. But as each year goes by, it's not happening, because we're on a pretty good stretch here. You know, we don't know the COVID year, the 2020 fall flight, or not fall flight, but the spring aerial surveys that they would do, and the 2021, they didn't happen. So we don't have those numbers. But 2022 and 2023 were pretty bleak, and I'm guessing 2024 is not going to look that great either. So at some point, do we need to go, hold on, let's reset a little bit, instead of playing this waiting game on the weather to get right? Maybe we take a little more conservative approach as hunters, and put some things in place until we get that big rain, and then the ducks bounce back, and we'll be great, because I don't want that hole to be so big when things do get right, which they eventually will, that we're having to climb out of such a hole that it's going to take long enough that we might hit another dry cycle again, and we just keep plodding along versus having some quote unquote good old days. So
yeah,
well, that's my concern.
Some of the stuff will bounce back quickly. You know, blue and teal recover quickly. But on the flip side of that, you look at white fronts. You know, we could be a decade of time of great conditions before white fronts would recover from where they're at. And, you know, that's for you and I, that's one reason this early spec season is such a controversial subject for the state of Arkansas right now. You look at where that population is at, you know, just to keep on harvesting them like nothing's going on is, I don't want to say foolish, but maybe questionable. But
yeah, for sure. Well, mallards will bounce back fast.
Yeah,
and you're right. You know, blue-winged teal and some of these others, they have shown over the course of time that they can bounce back pretty quick. They're pretty resilient. But I just hope we don't push them to the brink where it's a hard road to hoe. So white fronts. If white fronts are only breeding every couple of years, every 2-3 years, some of them, mm-hmm. that's going to take a while to build back up. And you take it on the hand that, you know, most of these or a lot of these outfitters here in Arkansas are killing 3,000 plus a season. That's a pretty good swipe out of the population. That you wonder, is that early season really necessary?
Necessary for what?
I know what it's necessary for. That dollar bill. Mm-hmm. And like I said, I'm all for somebody making money, but not running a resource in the ground.
Yeah.
Advocate for that.
Let's talk about some positive stuff for the last few minutes. So this will air Thursday. So if we miss this rain chance Thursday, we will very likely be planting rice. We got really close last week. We were about 24 hours out last week. Could have got some on the ground, but wouldn't have been able to pull our levees. So hopefully, fingers crossed, we can dodge this one coming Thursday and get some rice in the ground and start working on our first intentional ratoon crop. We've had some rice head out before. It usually always blank heads. So for those that are listening, rice is kind of like grass. Once you cut it, harvest it, it will, if you have a long enough growing season and adequate moisture, it will head out again. And a lot of times in our part of the world, that's few and far between, you know, usually can't plan on it. You don't know that it's going to happen. Last year was a good example. We had a really warm, really drawn out fall last year, but it was really dry. So by the time we see the rice trying to head out, it's too late. We should have put water on it long before to actually make it fill those heads up and turn into grain. So that's what a blank head is. A hull is there and there's no grain inside it. So anyway, through the Game and Fish and their pilot program this year, we've got some ground that we're trying to get planted early so we can harvest early, put water back on it, and hopefully have a warm fall again and see if we can make this head out. So that's pretty cool. I'm excited about that. And then we're holding a bunch of water still. Up until yesterday, still had about 500 acres of water and a bunch of ducks still hanging around, pintails and mallards at a surprising number right now, starting to see some blue wings come back through. Really a lot of fun to have ag fields with water right now and see the migration that is still ongoing. You know, for most hunters, to them, migration stopped January 31st, but it is still ongoing. There's still a lot of good that can be done for waterfowl, you know, into March and even April in the state of Arkansas, primarily on private lands, which another plug for those guys that are willing to keep that water and keep that table set for those birds. So that stuff's cool to see and pretty exciting. And you know, it's springtime. Things are going to change a lot here in short order.
Yeah, for sure. That's we've done the same. We're not trying to do an early crop like you are, but we've definitely left some water out. Now we have not seen many ducks here in the last month, but we did have those ones pushing back through, and I even saw some of that on some of Doug Osborne's tracking of some other GPS transmitter studies. You know how quickly those. A lot of ducks, or a lot of the, at least the transmitter ducks, push north. They're like right after the freeze. And they're in early February, and their noses weren't turned south. These ducks were headed north. And then you saw some of his transmitter ducks. I think he had transmitter like a 9 ducks, and you know, 2 of them went, and during that super lockup, they went to Illinois. A lot of them hung tight. A couple of them trickled into Arkansas. It was real interesting. It wasn't this wave like you thought. Okay, this cold front's banging down from the north, and all the ducks are going to push south. And as epic as that cold front was, and as long as it hung around, those ducks didn't move a whole lot. And we kind of saw that here in the state. So, yeah, there was some good hunting because they were bunched up and desperate and everything else and moving, but we didn't get this massive push of ducks. So I'm curious.
Saw some concentrations, right?
Concentration. So I say all that to say, I wonder where these ducks came from that you're seeing, you know, push back through. I mean, do you think they're mallards that have been around and they're just hanging out longer than normal, or is these ducks pushing from the south coming through headed north?
I don't know. That'd be really interesting to look into. I do think it's a similar correlation to what you're talking about with the cold front. You know, you've got these kind of ducks are really driven more on photo period. Now, for whatever reason, those that we're seeing right now, the mallards, pintail, whatever, and we know pintail are some of the first to go back, right? But for whatever reason, these are comfortable hanging out. Maybe they know that they're good right here. They're well fed. They don't have to go fight the ice line. You know, their body condition's good. They'll pick up and go whenever. Or maybe their body condition's poor and they're trying to get the body condition up to go back. That would be an interesting study. I know you and I have talked before about some kind of taking this platform into some fundraising to target, you know, some interesting studies. I think that one would be kind of interesting to do some banding, target some really late season banding to see what that is. Now, of course, your sample size is going to be small and you may not duplicate it year in and year out, but it would be interesting to look into that. I think another kind of study that would be interesting to get into, like we talked a lot about WRE last year when we went to DC with Ducks Unlimited for the farm bill. I think it would be interesting to ban kind of a long-term, you know, 10, 15-year study on a tract of land that is getting restored. So see if you have these phylopatric bonds being created and kind of just look at, in general, how did that property change over that time frame? Like what was the, could you measure the benefit to waterfowl as it went from ag to early successional into young timber? I think that'd be kind of a neat study to look at.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Not sure what you'd get out of it. Although maybe you could put a value on WRE and what that does for the resource. But
yeah, I mean, you could tell, okay, yeah, it's worth doing more of this, or no, this, you know, from a waterfowl standpoint, it's not really showing to produce, you know, suitable habitat for them like we thought. It would be interesting, especially over a long period of time. I guess you just have to keep put backpacks on generations of ducks to see that as that population builds.
Mm-hmm. You might could do it on the cheap too. I mean, GPS obviously shows a lot more than just regular bands, but you would still get a lot of information just from harvest data from that banding location, using it as a location over time. You know, how many birds are you recapturing and where are they going? I think that would give you an indicator. I mean, I don't know. We'll have to talk to Doug about that and see what he thinks.
Yeah.
But there's some interesting stuff. I think we could, I think we've got a pretty good audience that's paying attention and they're tuned in and they're interested. So I think we could explore the potential of some target research, that our listeners are interested in and motivated to be involved with.
Yeah, there'll be Dr. Osborne is going through what he saw this past year with his transmitter ducks the day this episode comes out that afternoon. So be interesting to see what he has to say, especially as it related to these ducks, you know, with this cold front that everybody was banking on and what really happened or what he saw across with his ducks. Because I've only seen that high level graph, and he's going to go into a lot more detail and do some Q&A. So that'll be interesting. And we'll obviously have him back on again. He was a great guest, and we had him on a few months ago. I'd encourage listeners, if you're just now picking us up, you know, go back and listen to some of our stuff in the past, because you hear us refer to it, because a lot of these things keep coming up. But there's some past episodes that are definitely worth sitting through and listening if you come onto the show here lately.
Yeah, if you're in love with the sound of our voices, you should go back and listen to all of them.
Yeah, yeah, that would be that's the key, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I don't know. Good to jump back on here. It feels like it's been a while since we've sat around and BS'd and got some really good guests lined up. I'm excited to get some of those folks on and just keep the conversation going. And appreciate all of the feedback. Look, agree, disagree. Everybody on social media that's commenting and paying attention involved. We're trying to put some information out on social media at the Standard Sportsman. Graphs and stuff that we may reference here, that, you know, this is obviously not a visual media. So if you want to see a little bit more of what we're talking about, go check us out on social media, get involved in the conversation there. We're getting a lot of messages regarding some topics people would like to hear about. So feedback is tremendous and much appreciated.
No, for sure. For sure. Cause yeah, you're right. We don't necessarily have to see eye to eye, and sometimes or oftentimes there's been some commenters that have had some great points and some different vantage points than what we've seen and different experiences, because we've reached an audience outside the borders of Arkansas. And part of that's by design, because we've had guests on here that don't have anything to do with Arkansas. And that's been pretty cool to see, to have people up and down the flyway interested in some of the things we're talking about and some of what our guests talk about. So we definitely appreciate that and love the interaction both sides. If it's a disagreement, both sides having an open mind to what's going on and willing to have conversations about it, because that's the only way we're going to get it right in the end of this thing.
That's right. Yep. Well, thank you all for following along today. Thanks for being involved on social media and I don't know, caring enough to listen. So you can check us out, social media at The Standard Sportsman or online at thestandardsportsman.com. And see you guys next week.
Light boots, the lightest pair of knee boots you're ever going to find. Weighed in at just 13 ounces each. Putting on a pair of light boots is truly a jaw-dropping experience.